90 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. It was arson. That's what authorities in California say about the state's largest wildfire so far this year. The Park Fire has exploded to nearly 125,000 acres near Chico in a little over 24 hours. Butte County DA Mike Ramsey says a witness saw the suspect, Ronnie Stout, roll a burning vehicle into a gully, then walk away.
She saw him get into the vehicle, do something in the vehicle, get out of the vehicle, and then push the flaming vehicle down the embankment, some 60-foot embankment down into a gully.
The fire is only 3% contained. Two top leaders in Mexico's Sinaloa drug cartel are now in U.S. custody. Ismael Zambada and Joaquin Guzman Lopez were extradited and arrested near El Paso. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Biden meet at the White House today with the families of U.S. hostages held by Hamas. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News, your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump are tied in Wisconsin in the first poll here since President Biden dropped out. The Emerson poll has Trump and Harris deadlocked at 47% in a head-to-head matchup. Emerson finds Senator Tammy Baldwin leading Eric Hovde 49-43. Wisconsin is investing in its rural agricultural roads. James Kelly reports.
The funding is part of the first round of awards through the Agriculture Roads Improvement Program, which will provide nearly $50 million for rural road projects across the state.
That's James Kelly reporting. The spending will support 37 projects across 28 Wisconsin counties. The projects are aimed at helping Wisconsin's agricultural industries by boosting infrastructure critical to moving products, crops, and livestock. And that's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
I'm Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. I learned about atrial fibrillation the hard way. My symptoms would come and go, shortness of breath, fatigue. I kept going. Then I got so lightheaded, I couldn't. My doctor said I have AFib, so I'm about five times more likely to have a stroke. Other symptoms, irregular heartbeat, heart racing, chest pain, can come and go, but the risk of stroke stays. If you have symptoms, tell a doctor. Visit notimetowait.com.
Sponsored by Bristol-Myers Squibb and Pfizer.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Got to talk about this IRS bill that the Republicans have thrown out there. And look, this would be right in there with the old Herman Cain idea of, you know, bills being no longer than two pages long. You can read them at the dinner table. This one's, you know, like a paragraph. Representatives Adrian Smith of Nebraska and Chuck Edwards of North Carolina, both Republicans, have proposed a piece of legislation. Vital, vital legislation. Now, understand, never going to pass. It'll pass the House, not going to get through the Senate, and President Biden will never sign it. Messaging bill of our values as a Republican Party. I'm going to read the whole thing to you. Section 1 is what it is. It's the prohibition of free direct file programs. It says the Secretary of the Treasury or the Secretary's delegates may not continue the direct file program of the Internal Revenue Service and may not develop or provide to taxpayers any successor program which provides a free public electronic return filing system service option. That's it. That's the whole bill. The whole bill is no. You pay to get your taxes filed. Wow. And, you know, the thing is this is who they are. They're telling us, they're showing us who they are. Now, Donald Trump's been one of those guys. We know who he is. But we're always kind of like, huh, that makes sense. I saw a New York Times review of the book. It's called All in the Family, written by Fred Trump. It's the son of Donald Trump's brother, Fred Jr. And it makes some interesting claims about Donald. Ones that I got to tell you, I kind of believe, because evidently they're talking about Fred has a son that was born with a medical condition, had some developmental and intellectual disabilities, had some real problems. And, you know, the family, you know, needed some help funding it. And, you know, evidently Ivanka and you know, Ben Carson and some other people, you know, were trying to do some things to advocate, and to, you know, to do some things to raise awareness, all that stuff. Evidently, Fred the Third, I guess it would be, was meeting with Donald Trump, and claims in the book that after the meeting, you know, Donald pulled him aside and said, you know, maybe those kinds of people should just die, given the shape they're in and the expense and all. And what he wrote in the book is, you know, according to Fred Trump, the remark wasn't a one-off. Evidently, he called, you know, later and asked for help. And, you know, he said that the kid was, you know, he's not really there, you know. He said, I don't know. He doesn't recognize you. Maybe you should just let him die and move down to Florida. And you go, you know, is this who this is? Yeah, clearly it is. You know, this is, again, another one of those stories you go, yeah. Now, the red hats will go, yeah, so what? I got to tell you, I don't want someone with that lack of compassion or empathy being anywhere near the button. And then you contrast that to Joe Biden, who, when his son was ill, you know, him and Jill were going to sell the house to pay his medical costs, to pay to help take care of the family. You know, there's a difference in policy views. So, you know, President Biden lives through this where, you know, struggle that average everyday people feel. And what does he do? He tries to move legislation to end medical debt, tries to help people, tries to make sure that, you know, what he went through, nobody else has to go through. And that's the kind of, I got to tell you, the kind of leader that I want. Understand, when I talk about on this program, a lot of it has to do with my life experience. I see things through a theoretical lens that has to do with the things that I've experienced in my lifetime and what people have explained to me and shared with me over the years. I have changed my positions on some things when people have better ideas. But I got to tell you, this idea that, well, you know, just let them go. Yeah, it's expensive. It's all fine, well, and good, unless it's you. And it's that ideal that, you know, we're all in this shark tank. It's just a matter of when we're going to be the flavor of the month. And I look at someone, and it's interesting I use shark. Because electrocuted or eaten by a shark. Maybe Donald Trump will share that story again. But I see these kind of books that keep coming out, this kind of information that keeps coming out. And I got to wonder, you know, when do we... us, no, I mean, all of us, not you know, folks who already know that this guy is not empathetic, that this guy is never going to look out for the little guy. When do we as a society wake up and go, this isn't the place we want to be? And I look at his Project 2025, read it. It's all there in writing for the world that they want to create. It's not the world we live in. It's the fantasy world that they want to live in. They want to live in a place where, yeah, they don't even know you're there. Just let them go. Now, again, this is a huge, huge departure from the party of just a couple of years ago that fought like crazy to keep Terri Schiavo alive. Interesting. Even though it was her will. Interesting world in which we live and times that we're in. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Okay, take a quick break. When we come back, you know, what will history remember about Joe Biden? I think it's going to remember him pretty well. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Gotta tell you, when historians look back at these last 4 years, the Biden years, when they go back and they look at this, and historians write what historians do looking to the past, they're going to look at Biden as one of the great presidents for working people. I mean, you think about the mess that he inherited, you know, the COVID, crisis, an economy that was reeling. Then you come out of, January 6th was part of this, a lot going on. And, he went out and said, look, we're going to transform this country, and has done that in very solid ways, reinvesting in the future of this country, our infrastructure, manufacturing, lots of good stuff. And in fact, I just saw the other day, an article on the fees for credit cards seems wildly popular. Well, now that he has stepped aside, but here to share some thoughts on, what were the last 4 years, and maybe what will the future look like? So I've asked David Madeline to come talk with us. David's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He's also the author of Reunion: How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. David, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, Rick, thanks very much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
So, like I said, I think people are going to look back at this administration in years down the road and say, as I've been saying, that we're living through a transformational period.
I think you're right. The Biden-Harris administration, as you mentioned at the beginning, started with a really terrible economy. COVID had wrecked our nation's economy as well as the global economy. And where they started from and where we are now, with we have had unemployment at 4% or below for about a record number of months. We have wages that are gaining, that are finally outpacing inflation. We have inflation on a much better trajectory, and we are making the kind of investments in the future that are really key, big in infrastructure investments in chips, computer chip plants, and in electric vehicles, the kinds of jobs that will be good in the future. And President Biden, as well as Kamala Harris, that gets also a fair amount of credit for this, an incredibly pro-union administration with lots of policies to help union workers and workers who want to become union. So I see both the right trajectory and a path forward that makes me optimistic about the future of the country if we continue in the same direction. At the same time, if we change, and I'm sure we'll get into some of the details, I'm definitely afraid of what the alternative would do to workers and union members.
No, and look, the reality is, I think Biden did everything that he said he was going to do in moving this country back towards worrying about working people, that bottom-up, middle-out thing he talks about, instead of this idea of trickle-down. He said, no, let's give the rich people all the money because they're smart. David, they know what to do with it, and they are, and they do. They make themselves more money. Doesn't ever seem to get down to the little guy. And here's a president who's finally saying, no, we're going to worry about getting good jobs for people, good opportunities, and we're going to rebuild the country and transform our trade policies and have an industrial policy for the first time in my life. There's so much to be excited for. And what's frustrating is he's not going to get credit for it probably in his lifetime.
Well, I don't know if you remember, I did this piece, I think we might have talked about it, where I went and talked to a bunch of workers on this electric vehicle facility that's being built outside of Tennessee, a massive federal investment. It's kind of furthest along of these kind of facilities, and it's being built under a project labor agreement, so really good union jobs. And I was talking to all these workers, and they previously had low paying, no benefits jobs, and they're going here and they're saying, this is the best thing that's happened in my life. My life is transformed. I went from being able to pay half my bills this week, half my bills next week, to now I'm able to take a vacation with my kids. I'm thinking about buying a house. I've got a bank account, all these really good things. And then when I asked them, well, how or why did this project come to be? Who do you credit? And they would credit Ford Motor Company as the number one thing. And that's where they would go. And then I would push and probe, and I could get them to say, yes, my union also was helpful in getting this project. I said, what about any elected officials, any money behind it, you know, President Biden or his policies? And they would sort of look at blankly and go, well, if any politicians had anything to do with this, I'd support them. Which to me gets to the thing you're talking about, where, yeah, we're going to learn. And the more we learn, he will, you know, his administration will get credit. The key question of whether that's going to happen in time for this election, or whether it's just historians who are going to be ranking the quality of his administration.
No, no, you're right on. And look, I said from the beginning, you know, if you remember, you know, the folks on the right were slapping stickers all over gas pumps going, you know, Joe Biden did this. I said you should have taken that, the image of that sticker, made huge 20, 30 foot, you know, cardboard statues or statues at some point pointing at these projects going, yeah, Joe Biden did this, to raise awareness. I mean, I see little signs, you know, brought to you by, you know, this investment act, but it's nowhere near going, hey, here's the guy who did this.
Well, that's, in fact, I think the key point. So some of these projects are federal infrastructure, traditional roads, bridges, and there are some small signs, as you know, but the vast majority of the projects that are being built, these factories, are private investments that are supported by public money through loans and tax expenditure, and that have zero signage other than the private company. Yep. There's no public acknowledgement. And in fact, when I talk to the workers, and I also talk to the unions there, they're like, I'm driving around this facility and there's nothing but Ford anywhere. There's no mention. So no wonder the workers don't know, which gets to the other point we've talked about many times, which is part of why unions matter so much, in that they help educate their members about how and why policy matters for their lives. It's a lot to expect the individual to know this project came from this policy, this job is dependent upon the project labor agreement and the like. Whereas unions, this is part of what they do. They educate their members about the policies that affect their lives, and that's why union members tend to vote more frequently than non-union members, and why they tend to vote for politicians who are pro-worker much more often. And they're less easily fooled by rhetoric that says I'm pro-worker without the reality of doing something behind it.
Well, look, as a union member for 35 years, it's always been vote your job. You know, make sure that the person who's going to make sure that collective bargaining rights are protected, prevailing wage laws are protected, you know, all of these safety protections are protected. You know, vote your job has always been something that I've heard. And I say that all the time. You know, everything I think springs from, can you afford to put a roof over your head and food on the table and then take a day off to go out and act and be active in your local government and maybe vote occasionally? You know, that to me, that's a little important.
Yeah, it's we you know, I think that's part of what's happening right now in society is this desire for stability. Like the economy has been really, really bad for working people for quite some time. There's this decades of really low wage growth. Then you have the financial crisis, 2007, 2008, and a collapse. And then you had COVID, another collapse. And people are like, we want to be able to breathe and get ahead and feel like we're going to not just immediately go back down again, which is where, to me, the policymaking is so important. Part of the reason people have been wages have been stagnant and the economy has really failed for working people is that policymakers have not paid attention enough to workers. We finally have an administration, as you were alluding to, Biden-Harris administration is really transforming the way policymaking is done in this country for decades by focusing on workers first and rebuilding the middle class as the central purpose. And that is just such a step forward from where we've been. And really, to me, one of the best things and the most important legacies, I think, from President Biden is just a rejection of the trickle down and a focus on policymaking that helps workers in the middle class.
No, absolutely. And but the thing that gets me, David, and this is where, you know, as someone who's been doing this for a while, I've been talking about this, you know, the attack on the working class, you know, for all 19 years of doing this program. So none of the stuff that people are angry about today, it seems, is new. We've been losing jobs. The standard of living has been falling for decades. It's all been bad policy that's gotten us into the mess that we're in. And finally, someone's going, hey, we should maybe change course. Now we're going to blame all of these decades of bad policy, of which he had voted for some in the past. But we're going to all lay it at his feet.
Well, you know, as Biden always was saying, you compare me to the almighty or the alternative. And that's, I think there's sort of two things that are important here. We can talk about the alternative, which is a very clear choice that's going to be bad for workers. And I want to get into that. But a track record of union busting and appointing union busters that, you know, Donald Trump has. He also has a Project 2025, which his former administration folks have written, which has a playbook for firing thousands and thousands of federal workers so that he can jam through his policies, including a whole bunch more union busting. So that's the really frightening thing. But on the alternative side, these sort of green shoots, what's happening that's good and why there might be a little bit more hope from the kind of policymaking we want. So under President Biden and Kamala Harris, we see communities that the so-called left behind communities, these counties with either have been hemorrhaging manufacturing jobs or and population, there is finally now increased investment in these counties. In fact, usually a disproportionate share, you know, study I've done showed that counties with that have lost manufacturing were more likely to get new investments out of this. So, you know, it's still a long ways to go, as you were learning, but there's actually signs of real focus and investment, is including for places that had been discarded and ignored and rightly frustrated.
Yeah, no, as I've been saying, you know, we're planning a tour for just before the election. You know, we're going to go to those places that used to be, that are now going to be, because of these investments. And I think, look, I think that needs to be highlighted, that if we had a functional media, you know, that would be something we'd be talking about. But, you know, making lives better doesn't seem to lead the news, only when things are destroyed. But I want to get to what you said. You said Project 2025, the Heritage Foundation and their they're really smart, well-paid, you know, chaos merchants have come up with this 900-page document. And I got to tell you, it never ceases to amaze me that they're willing to tell us how bad they're going to be, how much they hate the fabric of this country right now, and how they want to change it into ways that, I don't know, could take us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, not the 1980s and 90s. But for labor, this is horribly destructive, and they're, quite frankly, very open and honest about it.
Yeah. And let me start first. It's not just, you know, Heritage Foundation. These are former Trump appointees writing this document. And much of it is actually what he did in the first term for labor. For example, trying to make it harder to create new unions, harder to bargain collectively, firing the general counsel, who right now is very good. In fact, under the current NLRB, they were reinstated more workers who were illegally fired for union organizing just in their first year compared to all 4 years of Donald Trump. So real act, and they want to get rid of and undo all that. I find this, you know, really scary, because it's not only going to be bad for labor with these specific policies, but they are really credible threats based on the historic record, what Trump did in his first term. It is that on steroids. There's the record of, you know, as I said, appointing union busters to the NLRB, appointing union busters to the Department of Labor, the appointing Supreme Court justices who want to say that workers, if you strike, screw you, you're going to be out of luck. If you are trying to form a union and your company fires you, screw you, you're out of luck. Two rulings they've had in the past 2 years against, major against workers. And those are the kind of people he's appointed then. But now you add on the ability and the sort of freedom and to be even more authoritarian. And that's to me, the this 2025 playbook gets rid of lots of checks and balances that we take for granted,
yeah,
making it easier to do these extreme kind of policies.
No, I mean, you know, just yesterday we talked, or just the other day we were talking about project labor agreements and prevailing wage and how they're very explicit. They want to repeal Davis-Bacon, the prevailing wage law, and they want to end project labor agreements. Done. No more. You government saying you cannot do it and using the power of government to block anyone who really wants to. And this is they're writing this down. They're putting it on paper for people to read. So when you go into that voting booth in November, you will have already known what the options are. They're telling you what they want to do. And, you know, I still struggle with people going, I don't know.
Yeah, we're not comparing similar things. Certainly. Now, and I want to give Donald Trump and J.D. Vance credit for this. Their rhetoric is significantly different than most previous Republican candidates. They will occasionally talk a good game and talk about workers. And that's great. That's a big step forward because the power of the president is partly the bully pulpit. So that's a good step. But what really matters and what is most important are the policies that they're going to promote. And the track record is really bad for Trump and Vance. For example, today I was reading the Republican platform. So the Project 2025 is a scary list of all the bad things they would do. The platform does not mention the word labor or union in it. It has absolutely nothing. There's nothing in there. So it's there again, when they're telling you who and what they're doing and their record is clear and their plans are clear, there's no plan, no positive plan for labor. There's only a plan to hurt labor. I think that is a really clear choice for people to make and to know and need to understand that's what they're actually facing.
Yeah, but here's the weird thing, and maybe it's just the time we live in, but I think back to my grandfather and his generation. I don't know that they would have looked to a billionaire and a vulture capitalist as the voice of the working class. I maybe call me strange. I just don't think that my grandparents' generation would have found solace in the people who made their lives miserable.
We are living in weird times, and if only that anyone, you know, labor and workers need allies. If it's the natural allies are not billionaires and venture capitalists, and usually when push comes to shove, even when those kind of folks are saying nice things, they stick with their friends and the money.
Yeah.
And
Howard Schultz is a perfect example of that. I gotta tell you, he could have been Secretary of Labor had Hillary Clinton won. And look what he did at Starbucks. But here's the thing. We hear a lot of this unicorn thinking of, you know, we're gonna be bipartisan. I was reading through, you know, some of J.D. Vance's, opinions on labor and this idea of this kind of like almost a throwback to the old company union thoughts. I'm curious, have you done any looking into what Vance's ideas on labor and what Project 2025 says about maybe what unions should look like in the future? Because, look, we don't want those militant unions who are going to strike and demand. We would like much more compliant, much more, you know, friendly employees, much more pliable workforce, if you will. Have you seen anything?
Yes. In fact, both Vance and Project 2025 have a policy, you know, oftentimes known as like the Team Act, where it is companies can set up the union, not the independent worker-led union, but the company can set up the union to facilitate a better productive relationship between workers and management. And, you know, so obviously this is a fear. We have a long history in the United States of company unions. That's partly why when the National Labor Relations Act was written in the 1930s, it explicitly prevented company unions so that workers could have a real choice of an independent organization to represent them. So this is going back to, as you mentioned, the 1890 kind of place. It's also worse. So it's possible for someone to say, you know what, I want to have a better relationship with workers and management.
I have no problem with that.
Fine, but this is a bad policy on its own. It's even worse when you couple it with everything else. There's no support for the PRO Act. Zero, nothing. This is, at a minimum, to increase penalties on companies that violate the law and fire workers for trying to form a union. No support for that. Nothing. So it's just, it really is an additionally scary piece of legislation when you couple it with what else is there and not there.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, it's in writing. And look, with the PDF, you can keyword search. You don't have to read all 900 pages. You can look for what's important to you. You want to hit labor, it'll get you there, and it's all bad. But David, I appreciate you sharing some thoughts with us. As always, great stuff.
Rick, thanks for having me.
David Madeline, senior fellow there at the Center for American Progress, AmericanProgress.org, the website. Make sure you check out his book, Reunion, How Bold Labor Reforms Can Repair, Revitalize, and Reunite the United States. Quick break, right back.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price for the overnight. Clear skies and light winds. Sunrise temperatures in the mid and upper 50s. On Friday, sunshine, but look for that haze to continue thanks to wildfire smoke. Highs will reach the upper 70s, close to 80 degrees. Right now, it's 64.
The Todd Alba Show.
Reed Galen, co-founder of the Lincoln Project on Project 2025.
Donald Trump, Mr. Vance, when you say mass deportation, what do those words actually mean? Tell me how you're going to identify those people. Tell me where you're going to put those people. Something like a mass deportation suddenly becomes a massive forced roundup of people who maybe have been here 6 months and maybe have been here 60 years.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays noon till 2 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Wednesday, the House Education and Workforce Committee's Subcommittee on Workforce Protection, they held a hearing. And, well, you would think a group called the Subcommittee on Workforce Protection would actually be about protecting workers. But, you know, we're in weird times. The title of the event, Safeguarding Workers and Employers from OSHA Overreach and Skewed Priorities. What? One of the folks who did testify on the panel is my next guest, Jordan Barrett, former Acting Assistant Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Labor for OSHA during the Obama years, also does the definitive site on workers being injured and something we should all check every day, jordanbarrett.com/confined space. Jordan, thanks for taking time for us.
Glad to be here, Rick.
So let's start with the point of the subcommittee hearing on overreach by OSHA. Tell me about it.
Well, the hearing was clearly just to trash OSHA rulemaking and particularly OSHA's efforts to issue a heat standard and a few others. Interestingly, though, there was a industry association there lobbying for a standard that will cover tree care workers. That's one of the few times you ever see an industry association lobbying for a standard, mainly because they're trying to kind of put the landscapers out of business, you know, who kind of take away the tree care people. So they were kind of, it was kind of this double criticism of OSHA. You're working on all these stupid standards that we don't need, like heat, and yet you're not working on the standards you should be working on, like tree care. Actually, OSHA's working on both of those. But as I kept telling them, and I told the witness from the Tree Care Association, OSHA just doesn't have enough money, funding, you know, to do everything it wants to do on the regulatory side. And their hero, you know, Donald Trump, cut OSHA's funding for regulations by 10% when he was in office. And that only just caught up last year, back to where it was in 2016. So, you know, if they want to complain about OSHA not moving faster on some of these rules, they should look in the mirror.
Yeah. You know, I saw a statistic, and maybe you can, you know, tell me if it's true or not, but it's something like 170, 180 years for OSHA to go and inspect every workplace. And that's never going to happen. But just the scope of our economy and how small this agency is, this seems like, you know, putting the finger in the dam there.
Yeah, and yeah, so I think once every 186 years, if OSHA were to, you know, visit every workplace just once, which means that you know, unless you kill a worker or there's a serious injury or a you know, rare worker complaint, most employers are likely never to see an OSHA inspector, you know, and so it's kind of hard for OSHA to enforce some of these things. And a lot of these jobs, you know, these tree cutting jobs, you know, unfortunately, there are these like two guys in the pickup in somebody's backyard. So it's like really impossible for OSHA to find most of those things, right, unless somebody calls them in.
You know, look, it's interesting you bring that up, because I sometimes fall down the video crack rabbit hole. You know, whether it's, you know, Reels or YouTube or, you know, these little videos, and somehow my algorithm keeps feeding me, you know, workers doing dumb things.
Yeah, right.
You
know, right.
You see the guy down in, you know, 20 feet down in a hole with no protection around him. You see the guy driving a forklift from behind the forklift with levers, and you go, why are you doing that? And two, what employer allows that? Because again,
yeah, well, that's the question.
That opens them up for a liability. Yeah. But you see all this stuff, people posting their stupidity, and you go, maybe, I don't know. I'm struggling with it.
Well, this is, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Rick, because George W. Bush's second OSHA director, you know, his first speech on the job, this is Ed Folk, his first speech on the job was showing a slideshow of workers, as he said, workers doing the damnedest things. And it was all these workers doing really, you know, stupid stuff. And I remember I wrote something about that. I just lit into him because, you know, if workers are doing dumb stuff, that means bad management. That means they haven't been trained. They haven't been given the right equipment. You know, they're not, you know, they're told to do the stupid things. It's not the workers that are doing stupid things. It's bad management. And that's why, you know, OSHA is, that's why the Occupational Safety and Health Act requires employers to provide a safe workplace and gives the responsibility to employers to make sure that workers are safe.
No, I mean, this is one of those things that, you know, you go, why would you post this? Because clearly there's a problem here. But two, who allowed it to happen? But the other side of this, and what I was preparing, you know, talking to you, and I'm like, you know, is this like video evidence? Could there be like a video, you know, enforcement? You go, look, this guy did some dumb stuff. We need to hunt this down. If nothing more than to correct it, as opposed to, you know, being, you know, fining someone or being punitive.
Yeah. I mean, I walk around my neighborhood. I walk the dogs. We got a lot of dogs here, and I walk them. And I'm always seeing, you know, workers on top of roofs and workers down in trenches. And I, you know, I file OSHA complaints and I take pictures of them doing that. But it's not because to show how stupid they are. It's to show how, you know, their managers are not complying with the law and with OSHA standards.
Yeah, look, you brought up the roofs. I was watching a commercial. And, you know, it's one of those ads. You know, are you looking for a roof? Here's our team doing roofing work. None of them had any tie-offs. Yeah. They're just walking around, you know, two stories off the ground. You know,
yeah.
And you go, one, who would want to put themselves in that position? And I know, you know, look, I'm a dumb man sometimes. I do dumb things. But, you know, as your job, why would you allow yourself to be put in that position other than employers force you into it?
Well, either employers force you or you haven't been trained. You don't know. I mean, a lot of, you know, especially construction jobs, you know, a lot of those are immigrant workers. Some of them are undocumented immigrant workers. They've maybe never been trained on how to do that. They haven't been provided with the equipment. And even if they know that they're not supposed to be doing that, even if they know it's dangerous and life threatening, they may be afraid to file an OSHA complaint, or they may not know how to file an OSHA complaint.
Yeah. No, look, this is one of those reasons. And I go back to this all the time. I've had a union card in my wallet virtually my entire working life. Mm-hmm. And for that, I am eternally grateful, because I've never knowingly taken an unsafe truck on the road. Right. You know, I've had people say, you got to take that. No, we're going to fix this. And this is where having that union card gives you a sense of empowerment and the ability to not have to do dumb things.
Yeah. And to protect you against retaliation if you do, you know, file a complaint.
So I look at this and, you know, the hearing, what's going to come out of this? I mean, it was about heat protection, right?
Well, it was about all OSHA standards. It was about, you know, OSHA overreach. They shouldn't be doing a heat standard. And then misplaced priorities. They should be, you know, doing trees instead of heat, or trees instead of workplace violence, or trees instead of infectious diseases. Yeah, it was basically, again, just to kind of trash OSHA all around, you know, criticize them for not, I mean, you know, one of the main criticisms that some of them kept bringing up, although they wouldn't let me answer the questions, was, you know, how can some, you know, bureaucrat sitting down in the basement of some, you know, Washington office know better than, or care more about workers than, you know, than this fire chief here or this tree, you know, tree care person. And I kept trying to explain to them that OSHA, you know, has one of the, I mean, OSHA does the best job it can. They write a proposal. They have a very robust public comment period. I mean, they have a whole long public comment period, written comments. They have hearings that go on for days, sometimes weeks, if it's a big standard. And then a post-hearing comment period and briefs. And they are required by law, and judges hold them to this, to consider every comment made and then justify either why they, you know, took the comment or why they rejected the comment. So there's an enormous amount of public input that goes into this. It's just the exact opposite of some guy sitting in a room, you know, writing up standards all by himself without any knowledge of what's going on in the industry.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, especially, you know, in talking about the heat standard, I just saw, you know, I don't know if it's accurate or not, but I just saw one of the climate activists say that we've had the other day was the hottest day on the planet in, like, you know, 100,000 years. And I don't know how you make that claim, but it was freaking hot. That's all I know. And if you're working out, you know, as I do in the elements, if you're working on a roof, if you're, you know, heaven forbid, you know, in the South where it's even hotter, I think, you know, maybe getting a break every now and again, not a bad idea.
Yeah. So that was the criticism. You know, the standard gives workers breaks, so that'll cut into employer productivity. Workers should be responsible themselves for drinking water. Workers should be responsible themselves for just taking a break anytime they want to or they need to.
Wow.
You know, workers actually have control over that. Right?
Taking a break anytime they want to? Well, what employer does that?
Exactly. And so you're working out in the fields. So can you go wandering around, you know, take some time off? I think I'll take some time off, go see if I can find some cold water. Maybe I'll take a break in the shade. I'm sure, yeah, every employer will just say, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, take it easy here.
Yeah, hold on, Jordan. I'm going to take a break, okay?
That's why, yeah, OSHA is thinking, I mean, they're requiring, you know, you have to take 15-minute breaks. I mean, there have been all kinds of studies showing that, you know, heat impacts productivity. If you're working in hot conditions, workers are not as productive. And it makes sense in terms of not just worker health, but in terms of productivity to make sure they have breaks, make sure they have water available, make sure there's shade. You'll get much more work out of your employees and they will be safer.
You know, that sounds like common sense. It kind of does. But when you start talking about, you know, the bottom line and there's this view, I'm not saying by all employers, but by some, that look, you're just a machine. You're part of the machine. You're just a number on the balance sheet. I gotta work you to squeeze every ounce of labor out of you. You know, these are what these rules are put forth to make sure that, you know, people don't abuse people. Look, there are good employers who care about their workers and do the right thing, and great, we want more of those. But this is to protect them as well as protect their workers. No.
Yeah. I mean, they kept the Republicans kept coming to me and saying, do you really believe that employers don't care about their workers? You know, their employees or their family, you know, why would some, you know, pointy head bureaucrat care more about these employees than their employer does? And I said, yeah, I mean, I think most employers do. They want to do the right thing. You know, they protect their employees, but there are a lot out there that don't, that will cut corners. They'll try to save money, cutting corners on safety and health. And that's why we have so many workers getting sick and killed in the workplace every year.
No, I mean, did you not see Prime Day? Bernie Sanders committee's report on Prime Day 2019, 45 out of 100 workers at Amazon had some kind of an injury because of the heightened speed and all of the expectations. Yeah, I got to tell you, I don't think Amazon really cares.
Yep. And you know, it's fairly common sense that if you you treat your employees better, you make sure they're safe, that they're going to be, you know, not only happier working for you, but they'll be safer and be more productive. So, it's stupid arguments.
I got to ask you about this though, because, you know, we hear this frame that, you know, if we're going to force, you know, private sector employers and the private sector to do something, why doesn't the public sector have to do it? And this is one of those issues that I'm in agreement with that sentiment, because there's still 23 states in this country that don't have these kind of workplace protections for public sector workers. I look at my state of Pennsylvania for years. My friend Pat Harkins, state representative here, he's been pushing this Jake Schwab worker safety bill that just doesn't seem to get across the finish line, even though it is common sense. We should be protecting all workers.
I mean, it's true. Yeah, there are 8 million public employees in this country that don't even have the right to a safe workplace. I mean, I've been working with unions and other workers around the country, been working with workers in unions in Pennsylvania since the early 1980s. On trying to get public employees protected. I mean, these are workers that do the same. They dig, they work down in trenches. They work outside in the sun. They do they work on highways. I mean, they do, prisons, hospitals, mental health institutions, social workers. They do just as dangerous work as private sector employees. And yet they are not covered by OSHA in 23 states.
So, I want to bring this back to, clearly November is coming up and, I don't want to get you in the middle of a political fight. But, I got to tell you, this is one of those issues for me. It's another one in a long line of issues where you go, which side are you on? Donald Trump had a record at OSHA that I don't know that is all that great. I think Joe Biden's has been much, much better. I'm curious if you have any thoughts.
Yeah, no, I mean, Biden's been, OSHA hasn't issued that many standards in this, but they've made a lot of progress on them. And if there's another term, you'll see a lot of good OSHA standards coming out in that second term. It's been very supportive, tried to be supportive on the budget. Unfortunately, you've got, Republicans in Congress that haven't been as supportive. And then you have Donald Trump, who cut OSHA's budget when he was there and basically mothballed a bunch of the standards that OSHA was working on. And then you look at Project 2025. It's got all kinds of terrible stuff in it. They're calling for OSHA to not cite employers on their first infractions, small employers on their first infractions, give them a break if, they
get a mulligan
somebody the first time. And then taking away, the wage and hour child protections, in other words, letting kids work in coal mines and meatpacking plants, work with radiation, just turning it all back to employers to, run their workplaces as they feel they want to.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like, Jordan, we're making child labor great again.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And as my favorite, quote, which I think I told you before from a Wisconsin legislator was, the answer to worker shortages are not shorter workers. And it's true. I mean, they even mentioned in Project 2025. I mean, if you read it, it's amazing. It says, some kids want to do dangerous work. And I was like, have you ever had teenagers, especially teenage boys, they all want to do dangerous shit. That doesn't mean you allow them to do it. It's just amazing.
No, it's this is the argument that they've been making silently for years, but now it's they've written it down.
Yeah.
This is the amazing part of this. We know how bad they want to make this country.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's really dangerous and more, basically it'll kill more workers and more kids, unfortunately, if they get their way.
I mean, look, you've spent your whole life in this world. I mean, your work life has been OSHA and you've been in and out of that for years. Could you ever imagine it was going to get here?
Now, I remember, even back in the Ronald Reagan's and George H.W. Bush days, OSHA would issue standards. I mean, most of the standards that OSHA has issued, and there haven't been a whole lot, since OSHA was created, were issued under the Jimmy Carter and then Ronald Reagan and then George W. Bush. It's only been relatively recently since George W. Bush and certainly Trump that Republicans just have stopped issuing standards and they're really just trying to totally dismantle OSHA. There used to be, some bipartisan support for OSHA, even if it wasn't great. I mean, I'm not praising Reagan because he cut OSHA's budget and he cut the number of inspectors. But, they still issued standards and they still did the job. And that's totally unlike the Republicans of today who, would, if they had the votes, would just eliminate OSHA.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the amazing part. At least in the past, when there was this aura of potential bipartisanship, they weren't absolutely horrible. Well, I guess it's, do you want to die slowly or do you die quickly? I guess that's what this election's going to get us. But Jordan, I appreciate you taking some time sharing your expertise and great deal there at the hearing.
All right, Rick, thanks for having me.
Thanks so much, Jordan Barab, former Acting Assistant Secretary and Deputy Assistant Secretary of Labor there at OSHA. I want to hear your thoughts. Have you seen things at your workplace that maybe shouldn't be? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break, right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1898. That was the day that the United States Armed Forces invaded Puerto Rico. The invasion was part of the Spanish-American War. In 1898, the U.S. State Department noted, quote, "It seems to be conceded that every year we shall be confronted with an increasing surplus of manufactured goods for sale in foreign markets if American operatives and artisans are to be kept employed year-round." Many business leaders in the U.S. clamored for market expansion. At the time, Spain was still a colonial presence in the Caribbean and Pacific. When a revolution in Cuba sought to drive out the Spanish, in the United States, the drumbeats for war began to boom. Many saw this as an opportunity to expand the U.S. sphere of influence, although some labor leaders warned against war. One official from the Longshoremen's Union warned working people, quote, "If there is a war, you will furnish the corpses and the taxes, and others will get the glory." But soon labor leaders, including the president of the American Federation of Labor, Samuel Gompers, got swept up in the war fever. In just a few months, the U.S. ousted the Spanish and became the colonial power in not only Puerto Rico, but also Guam and the Philippines, as well as Hawaii. This gave the United States footholds in the Caribbean and the Pacific. The small island of Puerto Rico remains a U.S. territory to this present day. Since the U.S. invasion, there have been movements for both Puerto Rican independence and also for full U.S. statehood. Today, the Puerto Rican people face a severe economic crisis, towering debt, and an unemployment rate more than double that of the United States. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out our website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So, new book out. Dawn's Early Light by Kevin Roberts. Now, you may know Kevin Roberts. Who's Kevin Roberts? Oh, yeah. The guy who's the head of the Heritage Foundation. The guy who said there's a second revolution coming and it'll be bloodless if the left allows it. Remember that guy? Yeah, evidently it's circulating now that Donald Trump's number two. Because remember, Donald Trump knows nothing about Project 2025. Knows nothing about it. Nothing. Never even heard of it. Problem is, his number two wrote a foreword in the book and tweeted out just several days ago, before obviously the big nomination, that he was thrilled to write the foreword for this incredible book, you know, Dawn's Early Light by Kevin Roberts. And JD said it's a book that contains a bold new vision for the future of conservatism in America. And what he says is, never before has a figure with Roberts' depth and stature within the American right tried to articulate a genuine new future for conservatism. He says, we are now all realizing that it's time to circle the wagons and load the muskets in the fights that lay ahead. These ideas were an essential weapon. Understand that, because you know they have laid out in this 900-page Project 2025 exactly what they want to do to you, exactly how they want to change this country into their perfect version. Not the more perfect union that we, the American people, want, but what they want. What the think tank world thinks is best for us. And that is, you know, control of the elites. This idea that they're selling, and it's intoxicating to believe, what? We can have Athenian kind of democracy where we're all in charge of our own destiny? I love that idea. It's not possible. If government isn't making decisions,
about what happens to our planet, what happens in the workplace, what happens in to consumers, to workers, to women. If government doesn't have a hand in that, who will? Well, the individual, we're told. Yeah, which individual? Oh, yeah, the very wealthy, the corporations. Because understand, we've got a Supreme Court that decided if you work for a company where the owners don't believe that women should have contraception, they don't have to provide it in their health insurance. Now you go, well, you have the choice to go somewhere else. Yeah, that sounds nice. But for people who've been in a job for a long time or it's the best job they can get, that's problematic. So do you then give up your autonomy, your personal beliefs so that you can have a job? Is that the world that we want to live in? Well, that's the world they want us to live in. They want to be able to have the handful decide for the rest of us. And you go, well, government decides. Well, government is us. Government is we the people. If you don't like what is happening in government, maybe it's us. Garbage in, garbage out. And maybe we need to come back around to some ideas of what we want. Sadly, for too long, I do believe that, you know, we've been divided, sliced and diced, pitted against each other on lines that, well, have been dividing us for a very long time. Race, gender, orientation, color of our hair. And the reality is the color of our hats, red, blue. The reality is all that matters is green. The owners of this country, the people who are titans of industry, are the robber barons of this, the second gilded age, they know exactly what they want. They want more power and more control. And the only way to get more of that is to destroy the only opposition in the way, and that's a government of, for, and by we the people. Perfect example. Earlier this year, the Biden Federal Trade Commission went through an extensive program to get, you know, people, a comment period to get people to comment on these things called non-compete agreements. You go, well, what's that? Well, that is if you work for an employer and they say, look, you have to sign this agreement that you can't work for anybody else that does anything close to what we do. And the perfect example for me has always been Jimmy John's, the sandwich shop, who forced their employees to sign these non-competes. Now, granted, they're completely unenforceable, but just the act of going, oh, I can't go across the street or I can't go home and make peanut butter and jelly because that's proprietary. That's where we are. But initially, we had this ban on non-competes that the Federal Trade Commission pushed forth. A Republican judge down in Texas, overturned that. We now have a judge in Philadelphia, Judge Kelly Hodge, who has written a decision that says, look, the FTC absolutely has the power to ban these anti-competitive non-compete agreements. And look, there are about 30 million people in this country, about 20% of all workers who have had to sign these. So this is a big deal that nobody talks about. Now, here's the thing. It's going to go probably before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has already ruled that in the overturning the Chevron doctrine that, well, you know, government doesn't get to do this stuff anymore unless it's explicitly written. And I do believe that this Supreme Court will overturn this ruling down the road and make non-competes great again. Because this is the world that corporate America wants. This is the world that the wealthy want. They want compliant, desperate working people to do their work, clean up their mess, and not demand better or ever get better. The weird thing about this case, it was a tree trimming company that brought this case against non-competes. I'm sorry, I didn't realize sawing a branch or cutting trees somehow, I didn't know that that was proprietary. I didn't realize that there was such highly technical, highly skilled secret information that couldn't be shared of cutting down trees. but we will see. Anyway, I'm mind blown. If you missed any portion of the program, make sure you grab the podcast. The video over at freespeech.org, check that out as well. And I always want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Email Rick.
You're listening to The Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.